Hello and welcome to The Nature Between Us, a podcast for all your eco inquiries and musings. My name is Tessa. I'm an Aussie actress, voiceover artist, and environmental master's student on a mission to demystify the big environmental issues of our time. Join me on my quest to find solutions and positivity from the wide variety of people working towards a more sustainable future. This podcast is recorded and produced on Bidjigal and Gadigal land of the Eora Nation, and I acknowledge the traditional owners and pay my respects to elders past, present, and emerging. This is episode number 4, and we are talking cities. Now, chances are you live in one. In Australia, around 71% of the population live in a major city, me included. And that's not even counting those that commute to cities for work or travel for pleasure. City living can be really fun. The human connection, the culture, the nightlife, there can be many draw cards. But sometimes cities can be really clunky, and with population density on the rise, they're also heavily dependent on natural resources. It's crazy to think that they take up only 2% of the world's landmass, but consume over 2/3 of the world's energy. But what if urban design and planning could recreate cities to be not only sustainable and regenerative, but the most livable places on Earth? Well, they can. And today's guest counsellor, Jess Miller, filled me in on how. If you're a Sydney local, you might already know Jess. She was first elected to Sydney City Council in 2016 and is one of the youngest people to hold elected office. She served as Deputy Lord Mayor from 2017 to 2018 and is a big advocate for the environment, sustainability, and a diverse nighttime economy. She's currently the Deputy Chair of the Environment Committee and sits on the Cycling Advisory Committee. If that isn't enough, Jess is also an impact strategist at the Socially Conscious Republic of Everyone. We discuss what makes a city livable, how Sydney transitioned to 100% renewable energy, and the importance of connection to people and place. She's vibrant, she's funny, she's known for her creative and inclusive approaches to urban sustainability, and I was stoked to get a slice of her busy day. Hey, Jess.
How are you?
Yeah, I'm good. Thanks. I'm really good.
That's good.
I guess a really nice place to start our chat would be to get some background on you. You're originally a Melbourneite, but I know you've been living in Sydney for quite a while now. I'm curious, what were the main influences on you growing up that's kind of led you to pursuing a career in sustainability and politics?
Yeah, well, I am from the Mornington Peninsula, from a place called Somerville, which is located around about an hour and a half southeast of Melbourne. So I grew up on an organic herb farm, which was called Miller's Herbs. It was pretty original. And the tagline was grown the old fashioned way. So my dad was, somebody who, before Bunnings was introduced into the world, used to hand grow, cottage plants, lavenders, herbs, and succulents for people to buy at nurseries and for markets. And also provided a whole lot of root stock for commercial growers. So I guess most of my life, or until I moved out of home at 18, I was surrounded by plants and very, I guess, sensitive to how difficult it is to make a living growing plants, but also how important seasons are, availability of water, the quality of the soil, and also just the diversity of the types of plants that we were able to grow. So, I mean, at one stage, I think we had 12 varieties of mint. We had, you know, 8 types of thyme, you know, endless varieties of lavender and all this sort of stuff, and a lot of medicinal herbs that I think we've kind of lost in sort of since the homogeneity, like the homogenization of plant species through big nurseries. So yeah, that's kind of where I have come from. But like, I remember swearing to my old man when I was a kid. I was like, I never want anything to do with plants. I hate plants. I hate going to market at 4 o'clock in the morning. I'm never going to do this. And yeah, so he thinks it's hilarious.
Yeah. Isn't it funny? You kind of, you can't, you can take the woman out of Somerville, but you can't take the Somerville.
I don't know. Have you ever been to Somerville?
I spent a bit of time on the Mornington Peninsula, but only really where there's waves.
What
I'm picturing isn't really accurate.
Well, think of Somerville as like the gateway to the peninsula. So yeah, all the waves were about 15 minutes down the road, but we were constantly bargaining and bartering for like lifts. So that was kind of my currency growing up. It's like not so much pocket money, but you know, Dad, if I help you unload the truck, can you drop me off at Shoreham? Or if I help you do the market, can you drop us off at Gunnamatta or St Andrews afterwards? So yeah.
Yeah. That's so great. I love that early kind of experience with like the community, it's like a community bartering system in a way that like locally grown, locally sourced, kind of like local economies. They're so important. And yeah, a lot of people grow up not having any kind of contact with that until much later in life. And then they kind of realize the importance of farmers markets and, you know, flea markets and those kind of like small scale community economies.
Yeah, and I think like one of the things that's so cool about my dad and sort of seeing him do his thing then, and you know, we had like 5 or 6 workers on the farm most of the time. He's still alive, but he's like a fabulous salesperson. So it was really the conversations that people were having at the market. So he'd, you know, dad'd hold court sometimes with up to 25 people, just talking about the plants and how to grow them and how to, you know, stop the snails from attacking them and all this sort of stuff. So yeah, it was really, and I think you learn a lot of that from osmosis and, you know, picking up little bits of information and bartering and sort of stuff like that. So yeah, I think the craft markets on the Mornington Peninsula and the Yarra, we went up to the Yarra Ranges and Red Hill and all that sort of stuff was really quite, you know, hated it at the time. But yeah, you do pick up some pretty valuable life skills from being exposed to that.
Yeah. I mean, mainly just like you're such a great communicator of science and of sustainability and kind of like a really great example of how to like engage people. And that makes sense to me now. It seems like your dad was also kind of like, without realizing, like a bit of a science communicator at the markets.
Yeah, and just not a scientific guy at all. He was just he's got a great sense of humor and he's a very approachable, funny man. So
yeah,
he knows how to talk a lot of crap, but he's really, really weird in an entertaining way. So yeah, I think I think you come to appreciate there are lots of characters on that scene. And yeah, it was a very tight sort of community, the market, and they're all, you know, the craft markets then, and I think still now, really the central ethos to all of them was make it, bake it, grow it, breed it. So everything at the market, and even going a wander around, you got to know, you know, the guy who made the egg cups from scratch and the beekeepers and the Del Grossos who grew the apples, and you become friends with them. So yeah, we did lots of, you know, passata making and bottling of the tomatoes, and you know, you'd swap from some herbs for some apples, and you know, the cappuccino man and all that sort of stuff. So it's a good little example of how a local economy can flourish, I guess.
Yeah. And so since then, that sounds like an absolutely magical upbringing. You've done a lot of really amazing stuff in your career, and you've ended up now at the Republic of Everyone, and also obviously a huge part of Sydney City Council. And a lot of your work now is aimed at creating a more livable city here in Sydney. So I'm curious if you can tell us some of the key things that make a city livable.
Yeah, right. Well, it's kind of like the things that make people what do they say? People are just complicated houseplants. Like, you need clean air, you need water, you need nutrients and sustenance. And I think what makes a city interesting and livable is connection to other people and a feeling that you belong and that there's something there for you. So I think in places that are both very urban and very dense, that can be a challenge, but it can be found a lot more easily. Like, I grew up in the suburbs, so it took a long, like, transport was something that was a constant issue. Like, you couldn't just jump on a bus and get to the beach. You had to, you know, you had to pester your parents to drive you there. But yeah, I think what makes communities work is connections to other people. And so it's really incumbent on people who design and have a responsibility in influencing and shaping cities to make sure that there are as many opportunities as possible for people to feel like they can connect to place but also connect to one another. And so increasingly acknowledging the importance of First Nations people and traditional knowledge is really key to that, and making sure that we are respectfully engaging and learning from First Nations people is really critical. Equity and affordability, making sure that people can just, you know, survive and thrive in cities is really important, and obviously making sure that the ecological systems throughout the city are balanced is really important. So looking at water, green space is my sort of wheelhouse, transport, culture, art, all of it. Like, nothing is more important than one other thing, but we are a codependent system, and when one thing's out of whack, there are repercussions for that.
Yeah. You've just kind of touched on all of the pillars that I want to look at in a little bit more detail in our chat. The first being kind of energy, because cities, obviously being the beasts that they are, we suck a lot of energy. But Sydney recently switched to being 100% powered by renewable energy, which is really cool. So are you able to kind of speak briefly to what that means and how it was achieved?
Yeah, of course. You know, Clover has been the mayor at the City of Sydney since 2008, and she's probably one of, I mean, it's not a long, it's, I'm not overstating it to say that she is one of the world's best examples of a climate leader. She called climate change as the single biggest issue in 2008, and she has not stopped working to make sure that everything the city does, you know, is about preserving, protecting and reducing our greenhouse gas emissions. So I think that's, like, really, really important. So she's not only been able to kind of set a vision for that from the beginning, but she's also had a really targeted and robust plan about how to achieve that from the get-go. And so that has led to energy reduction initiatives, water initiatives, open space and green space initiatives, big collaboration with all the major property owners in the City of Sydney. There's an evidence base, and then I think more recently, as part of our climate emergency declaration and as a result of her going to the C40 in Mexico, I think it was, you know, her clear message is that we need to do twice as much in half the time. So the purchase of the renewable energy, we spent $600 million on a renewable energy purchase. That effectively means that the city operations are all being fueled by renewable energy. I think it's about 4 or 6 years ahead of when we said we'd do it. That's been really significant, not just because we've managed to green our grid, but because we've ensured that the purchase benefits community energy projects within New South Wales. So we're kind of enabling that just transition piece to happen as well, and creating jobs in places like Wagga and the Shoalhaven and regional New South Wales, where communities have to find other ways of thriving.
Yeah. How difficult do you think it would be for other Australian cities to follow suit?
Well, the bonus from that purchase was that it was actually cheaper. So not only were we able to achieve a really good environmental outcome and invest in other communities, but it also reduced our overall spend. We got a fantastic deal. So the question is, like, why aren't all other cities in the world doing this? Particularly given that it's, you know, to me it's a triple point score. But, you know, the answer to that is that there has to be other levels of government engaged with this process, because like every other system, the energy system also has a whole lot of codependent elements to it, everything from distribution, storage, production. There needs to be a real rethink and real reimagination of how these things can be reformed at scale.
Yeah. As you mentioned earlier, that the role of transport also plays a huge part in, you know, not only connecting people within cities, but making it a more sustainable city. And you're a huge advocate for bicycles. And it seems that COVID has prompted quite a few more bike lane initiatives. So I'm curious, what was the rationale behind this? And more importantly, are they going to stay after COVID passes through?
Yeah, well, that's a really good question. I mean, the city has, again, like due to Clover making it a priority, the city has had a really well-formulated plan around sustainable and active transport for a really long time. So we kind of had the plans in place ready to go. We knew where the links were. We knew where the deficiencies were. So when COVID happened, the state government announced a range of funding to try and alleviate pressure on the transport system and also to put more money into like local infrastructure. So the idea of the pop-up cycleways was kind of like, it was ready to go. But what was really interesting is that it kind of challenged the way that we'd all always done cycleways. So in the past, cycling infrastructure took a long time. It was a result of a whole lot of, like, sometimes years of community consultation, and they were really expensive projects to get up. The difference in the approach with the pop-up cycleways is that it's probably a great example of tactical urbanism, whereby it's a light touch. It happened really quickly. That obviously put some people within the community offside because they didn't feel like they'd had their say. And it wasn't without its problems. But I think the thing that was really and continues to be really interesting about it is that it's an example of iterative design. So you do something open to the fact that it's genuinely may not be temporary. I mean, sorry, it may not be permanent. And that, I guess, gives you the freedom to improve it as you go. And that's sort of what the city has been doing in partnership with the state government. So, you know, like, some of the cycleways are fantastic and they'll probably stay. They may become permanent in their current form, but some of them may not be that good. And that's an ongoing conversation. I think that's a really interesting and really valuable change in the way we as government work with other levels of government and, you know, approach problems in a much more creative and, you know, open-ended way.
Yeah, and approaching these kind of issues with creativity, it seems like it's such an important part of coming up with solutions. I saw just the other day you were sharing a new project that is open for feedback at the moment, and it's called An Open and Creative City, which looks really cool. And I was hoping that you could tell me a bit more about this, seeing as it's happening right now.
Yeah, it is. I think this is the kind of final piece of policy reforms that have been in response to a lot of work that the city staff have been doing over a really long period of time. at the beginning, it was sort of, I mean, this work began before the lockouts happened, and it was sort of identifying that there were pockets within the city where there were just too many people out at night and bad things were happening. So unfortunately, the lockouts came in as a result of some really unfortunate incidences in the Cross. So that initial piece of work, that sort of evidence base, never really got a chance to be turned into policy. So long story short, when I came into council, we had to figure out ways in which we could sort of work around the lockouts. And the discovery was that the way to do that was through planning. So we looked at the late night DCP. We had about 10,000 people input into that consultation. And really that was about saying, well, okay, well, if the lockouts only affect three kind of areas within the city, where else can we find opportunities for the late night? And then if you delve a bit deeper, you go, well, what are the barriers that make it difficult for people to do more things at nighttime? It picks up on the agent of change and sound management practices. It looks at liquor licensing. So it's a huge raft of policy reforms, but at its core, it's about, I guess, doing the hard work, which is to make sure that people, and particularly creative people who want to do cool stuff in the city, can do so without having to spend their whole life dealing with DAs. So yeah. There's so much to it. It's really hard to kind of condense it all down into a soundbite, but the opening
that's a good explanation.
Yeah. Like the bit that we're doing, so we've done the late night DCP. So that determines what can happen where and until how late. So that bit's been done. The bit that's up for consultation at the moment is really about, use of creative spaces. So if you have a hairdresser's, how can we make it easier for you to host live music without having to go through all these, permissions and applications? Agent of change, which is a sound management practice. And I think there's another bit in there about later retail.
Yeah.
So please have a look at it.
I will. I was having a look on the website today. I was like, this is really awesome. I love seeing that kind of stuff happening because, like you said before, it creates more connections between people, and that is what cities need to be sustainable, because it's not just about, economic stability or environmental, it's social as well. And the more people that are outside using the spaces makes it, more viable to have them running.
So and a lot of that stuff too is really about supporting jobs. Mm. And I think that's become really, really critical, particularly among the creative sector post-COVID, and giving and attracting people back to the city, given that we can't travel. Like, how do we bring the world's best here? Like, we have the world's best talent here, but how do we support and encourage and amplify what they're doing so that, we can encourage people to come here and really experience Sydney in all of its full beauty and diversity and potential, rather than go, well, it's so much cooler in Melbourne, like I'm sick of that.
Well, that's controversial.
Yeah, well, it's real.
I want to take a bit of a sidestep now and talk about trees, because I know how much you love trees. But of course, if you're a city dweller, you might not have that much of a relationship with the environment and with nature. But at the moment, you're managing a program called Greener Spaces, Better Places. So, I'd love to hear about that program and why it's important for cities to have greenery.
Yeah, well, I've been doing that job now for almost 8 years, and that's with Republic of Everyone. And the whole ambition of that project is to make sure that as our cities grow, so too do our green spaces, because the benefits of green space to all people, and particularly people who live in urban places, are really well documented. you know, looking, being able to look at plants and trees makes you sleep better. It makes you feel better. It cools down the city. It stops, you know, green spaces make it, it fulfills an ecological service in terms of making sure that water is captured and fed back into the aquifers underground. It takes pollution out of the ocean. I mean, there's just, there's so many benefits to having green spaces and plants and trees in cities. But I guess that program at the beginning was about promoting the benefits and building, a movement of people all over Australia who could see the benefits of green spaces, but also encouraging a more collaborative, the program's really about collaboration and how can we learn from each other to overcome the barriers that prevent green space from happening. Because at the same time, there's this huge movement of people who really do appreciate the benefits of plants and trees. There will always be people who can't stand them. And there are always competing priorities in cities. So I guess core to this program is trying to get governments and planners and architects and people to, you know, prioritize living infrastructure, waterways, plants, trees, open space, gardens, verges, at the same level that we have always prioritized hard infrastructure like roads, schools, hospitals, and integrate the two so that, you know, it doesn't become an either or kind of discussion that we say, well, you know, affordable housing has to be affordable to live in, and people who live in affordable housing or social housing, you know, should have, or actually I believe should have more exposure and access to the benefits of green space than as everybody else.
And of course the, like, the inclusion of green space now is so, like, the variety of ways that you can include greenery into a city isn't just, oh, it needs to be a big thick tree in the middle of George Street, which of course would be like, you know, it would be difficult to just plant a huge tree. Like the, like at Broadway, we've got that beautiful big vertical garden, and like there's just so many different ways now that architects and urban planners are able to incorporate green areas that it seems like a no-brainer.
Yeah, it is. Like, to me it is. And it seems really simple. But when you start sort of picking apart, you know, centuries worth of very limited thinking about planning and ideas of the built environment and what's important that are often the legacy of predominantly white men setting the agenda of what's important, it's actually quite difficult to change that way of thinking, and it doesn't happen quickly. Mm. And so I think we're at a really, really interesting time in history, and I'm really optimistic about it at the moment, in that everybody seems to be having a collective breath and reflection about what's really important. And I would love to see, and I'm already hearing a lot about this concept of a regenerative city. Yeah. And to me, I think bringing that concept to life means that we also have to really meaningfully engage with our First Nations people and understand and celebrate and make space for them to lead this conversation about what custodianship and care for country actually is, and what it could look like in an urban environment. Because I don't feel as though we've heard enough of that, and I would love to see that kind of conversation being at the bleeding edge of where we go to next, because it's so rich and so it's just right. It, you know, when you hear people, First Nations people, talk about connection to country, like, oh, of course. And there is so much knowledge that needs to be put to the forefront of that conversation, so much we could all learn, I think.
Yeah, definitely. Similar to what you were just saying about the kind of collective, like, breath during the COVID shutdown. I heard you say on another podcast that you've taken delight in the mess. Controversial?
Controversial.
Oh, really? I didn't mean to bring it up. I just thought that I thought it was an interesting comment. And regardless of that particular comment, but just the opportunities to kind of recreate things better.
Well, I guess that's sort of like there's a bit of an anarchist in me, I suppose, that looks at, you know.
We need a bit of anarchist in our leaders, I think.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's not to diminish at all, the really serious stress and anxiety and fear and suffering that so many people have experienced as a result of the mess. But I think that, you know, whenever you're confronted with something that's broken or bruised or damaged or vulnerable, there's an opportunity for growth. And what it does is that it reveals that the thing that you thought was strong and resilient to begin with might not have been. And so in recovering from that and healing that, if we're doing it in a thoughtful way, we have the opportunity to recreate something better. Yeah. And I guess, you know, like,
I mean, the bike lanes are a perfect example of that, aren't they?
Yeah. Well, I guess it just gives people a bit more freedom to think creatively. And it also, it sort of does also take away this or reveal this mythology, I think, that many of us feel, is that, well, somebody has the answer, somebody's going to save us, somebody's going to figure this out, or they know what they're doing. And the reality is, in my experience, is like nobody really knows what they're doing, really. And when we all are all a little bit more honest about that, I think it does provide an opportunity to have a deeper conversation about what the solution could be, instead of just sort of, you know, re-pushing and reasserting this sort of conventional knowledge. So it gives, when things break or when things fracture or when they kind of fall apart, I think what it does is it gives, you know, and things get messy, there is an opportunity to rebuild and recreate and reimagine. And I guess that was sort of what I meant by, you know, there's a level of delight in that and going, wow, okay, well, you know, we all suspected that this wasn't really working, so what's the opportunity now to make it fairer or more efficient or more beautiful or more sensitive or more considered, I guess.
Yeah, definitely. Do you have a dream vision for Sydney? Is there kind of like is there a city overseas that you visited and you're like, this is a city that's doing it right? Like,
Not really. No, I think Sydney is its own special, ecosystem, and the people who live here are contributors to what it will be. The place is really special and individual. But you know, like, if I could sort of cherry pick bits from other cities, you know, I'd take the nightlife of Sao Paulo and Rio de Janeiro, and I would take the, the living buildings of Singapore, and a little bit of the, the little bits of Paris and bits, you know. I think it's sort of being inspired by other cities, but I mean, Sydney, you know, will always evolve and find its own expression. But what I really hope is that journey is one that's really inclusive and that gives lots of different people the ability to contribute meaningfully, because that's really what's going to make it a special place and a space, you know, a place that is regenerative and that is fair and that is resilient. So, I mean, yeah, it's strength through diversity and also acknowledging that cities and places are always evolving. So there is no end point, you know. Sydney will never be finished. That's such a bizarre concept. you know, you kind of walk around and you go, oh, when they've done this and done this and done this, well, then we'll be finished. And it's like, no, we're such a young city, and so there'll always be another layer to put on it and a little tweak here and a tweak there. So I think that's really exciting.
I've actually never thought about a city in that way, but it's so true. It will never be finished because, you know, like 50 years ago when they were paving all of the roads and putting in, like, you know, the all the roads through, like, the CBD, which have now been transitioned back to pedestrian kind of streets and a tramway.
Yeah.
They probably thought that would be its final form. And then, nope, now 50 years later, we're changing it again.
Yeah, it's a very, I think, it's a very, I don't mean to, like, be rude to anyone, but it's a very kind of patriarchal European concept of design, I guess. And I just think it's wrong because it's just so, it's about, you know, there's that kind of concept that you can throw into planning. And that's sort of the undertone to that is that you're in control, right? If we plan it, you know, we do a drawing, we do the engineering, we build it, and then it's finished. And it's like, well, no, it never will be because there could be an earthquake, there could be a pandemic, there'll be more people. I think that, you know, a lot of Aboriginal and Indigenous conceptions of place are so much more honest and real and true because they acknowledge that that we are just a temporary part of a thing that's much bigger, and that we are the result of all of those that became before us and all of those that will come after us. And that's a responsibility, and there's a duty of care in that, not a duty of control. So yeah, I think it's really interesting. I love listening and listening to, like, other cultural interpretations of place, and also how differently women, I think in particular, see the making of cities. So
I just have one final question for you, Jess. It's a bit more of a broader question, but it seems that you are tirelessly working on, you know, engaging the community and creating these positive changes. What is it that motivates you to keep going?
What else would I do, really? I don't really know what else. Like, would I stop and just go, oh, okay, well, my work here is done? No, I don't know. I think it's, I feel like if I am here for a very short time, I feel very responsible for, you know, my backyard, my street, my city, my city, you know. But, like, I just love what I do. Like, I feel honestly like I'm so grateful to be in a position where I love the work that I do. I get paid to be creative and solve really complex problems. I work with amazing people. You know, there are no tree people are just the best people to work with. I feel like I'm always being inspired. I'm always being challenged. There is no greater vantage point to understand people and places and cities than to be on the council, even though sometimes it drives me bonkers. I wake up pretty much every day with a smile and go, okay, cool, what have we got today?
Yes.
Yeah.
It seems like you're having a lot of fun, which is great. It's infectious.
Well, I just, why would you do it if you hated it? And I think, you know, I try and be self-aware enough and aware of other people that if something's not working, you got to change. Yes, and timing is really good. And, you know, I also, like, I've done, like, martial arts for nearly 15 years, and for me that's such a, it's totally different to everything else I do in my day, but it's also a really good grounding for me to sort of be in my body and think about things from a different perspective. So yeah, I'm very, very, very fortunate.
Very cool. Well, thanks so much for the chat, Jess. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Enjoy. Thank you, Tessa. Thanks for having me. It's a real pleasure to be with you.
Enjoy the rest of your day.
Thanks. Bye.
Thanks so much for tuning in. That was Councillor Jess Miller. You can keep up to date with her and all her amazing projects on Instagram at Jess Miller Sydney. And if you liked this episode, you can also subscribe and follow the official Nature Between Us Instagram account, which is at the Nature Between Us podcast. Thanks for listening. Catch you in a couple of weeks. Bye.